This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
How'd you get the spinach, old boy?
That's a funny thing. A guy I never see before in my life gives me 2,500 Kolaks. That's 200 federal diplomas. Are you listening?
200 skins? Why? What for?
I sold him some.
Well, you've got nothing to sell. We've already hocked your pivot tooth.
Well, it wasn't much, but it was all I had, and was he anxious to get it?
What did you sell him?
Look, Orville, I want you to keep very calm now and don't get excited.
What did you sell him?
You.
Oh, well, for a minute, Wait a minute. Get that guy and give him those fish back. What's the matter with you? You can't sell me. I'm not a horse. It's just the way I comb my hair.
That's Bing Crosby and Bob Hope in their 1942 movie Road to Morocco. This month began with the centennial of the birth of Bing Crosby, and it ends with the 100th birthday of Bob Hope. Crosby and Hope were partners in a series of road movies, which have been released on DVD. So have six Crosby movies from 1936 to 49. We're going to look back on Bing Crosby's early years. For many of us who grew up in the rock and roll era, Bing Crosby epitomized square, middle-of-the-road singing. But he represented something new, a sound that was jazzy and witty when he started performing in the 1920s. In fact, jazz critic Gary Giddens calls Crosby the most influential and successful popular performer of the first half of the 20th century. Giddens is the author of the first volume of a two-volume biography of Crosby. It explains how Crosby changed American singing and pop culture. Volume 1 concludes in 1940, the year of Crosby's first road movie with Hope. Giddens is also the author of books about Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker and won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his book Visions of Jazz. Gary, would you choose a Crosby song for us, an early song, that you think helps illustrate how he changed American singing?
How about Some of These Days?
And why are you choosing it?
Well, he did it fairly early in his career as a soloist in the early 30s. It's with a jazz group in Chicago, and it gives a good example of the way he used swing and how advanced a scat singer he was and how hip he was into jazz, because he quotes Beiderbecke's Beiderbecke phrase in his scat solo. And there's a lot of good players on this record, but Crosby outclasses them all.
This is Bing Crosby.
Some of these days, you're gonna miss me, honey. Some of these days, you're gonna be so lonely. You'll miss my hugging, gonna miss my kissing. You'll be so sorry when I'm away. Now you're gonna be lonely, just for me only. Cause you know, honey, that you had your way. And when you leave me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You'll miss your little daddy some of these days.
That's one of Bing Crosby's recordings from the early 30s. My guest, Gary Giddens, has written a new biography of Crosby. Gary, one of the things you're doing in this book is rescuing Crosby from the image of the square old man. In what ways did he transform popular singing? What was it before him? What do you think he helped change it to?
He radically changed pop singing. You know, if you listen to a couple of the really early Crosby records, they might not sound as startling today as, for example, Armstrong's first great vocal record, Heebie-Jeebies. They both started recording vocals around the same time, Armstrong 1 year earlier. But if you listen to Bing's, say, Muddy Water from 1926 in tandem with all of the best-selling vocal records of that year, it's astonishing how different he is. For the most part, singers in that period were tenors. They often used a kind of semi-falsetto style. They deliberately tried to sound effeminate. This was a great period for gender bending. The most popular star in vaudeville was a transvestite named Julian Eltinge, who was so popular that a Broadway theater was named after him. And male singers often sang in that high, kind of flowery way. They did not sing to emphasize the meaning of lyrics. Crosby was really the first to do that, in part because they were encouraged by song pluggers to be as bland as possible so as to simply sell the song and the sheet music. With Crosby, it no longer became about the song. It became about the singer. Crosby was the first white singer to really understand what Louis Armstrong was about. He was completely transfixed by Armstrong when they first met in 1926 in Chicago. He understood swing instantly. His time was extraordinary. And he was a baritone, a deep-voiced, virile baritone who really made you hear the lyric. And because he had such an intimate style, he created a kind of erotic edge that did not exist in popular singing before him.
Why were most male singers tenors in that period, whereas Crosby was a baritone? Why so many tenors?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I think that the tenor style first became popular, actually going back to minstrelsy, when there was usually a tenor solo. But for one reason, tenors' voices hang clearer in theaters without amplification. They're more easily heard. And when the technology came in, when radio started, radio was more conducive to baritones, deeper voices, more nuance. So in a sense, the new technology, both electrical recording, the condenser microphone, and radio technology, all were helpful to Crosby's style and made the baritone ultimately the dominant singer. In fact, except for Tony Bennett and, I guess, Elvis, it's hard to think of a major American popular singer of the last 70 years who isn't a baritone, while it's impossible to think of any singer before then who wasn't a tenor, from Al Jolson on down.
Crosby was known as a crooner, largely because he used a microphone. He didn't have to rely on a big projecting kind of voice. He's one of the first of the singers to successfully use the microphone and develop that style of singing. Did he actively want to use a microphone? Was this something he was really excited about, or was he just in the right place at the right time?
No, he understood the value of the microphone instantly. He began occasionally holding a megaphone, like many singers of that period. But audiences didn't like to see the megaphone because it obscured his face. So, and he had a problem projecting in larger theaters, especially when he got to New York. So when the microphone was taken out of the radio studio and out of the recording studio and finally created in such a way as that it could be used on a stage, he instantly took to it. But his real gift for the microphone began when he was working at the Coconut Grove, and even before that, actually, at the Club Montmartre in the late 20s in Los Angeles. And the audiences were just stunned at the way he would use the microphone. He almost as though it were a musical instrument. He knew instantly how to, you know, use them so that he wouldn't be too sibilant, or so that he could use dynamics. He could be loud. He could be soft. And he really altered his style in a sense when he realized he did not have to be stentorian. He did not have to hit the rafters or the last row in the balcony. And it changed his style, and it subsequently changed the style of popular singing.
Why don't we listen to Bing Crosby's debut recording? Why don't you introduce it for us? Tell us what's happening here, when he recorded it.
Well, this is Muddy Water from late 1926.
This is Paul Whiteman, the band leader.
Paul Whiteman was playing at the Million Dollar Theater in California when Bing and his partner Al Rinker were doing a vaudeville show. And a couple of the guys from Whiteman's band went to hear him and came back raving to Paul. Whiteman had been looking for some jazz talent. He was known as the king of jazz, but he had no jazz musicians. And he was looking for someone, and they recommended Crosby. And he signed them, actually, without hearing them. He invited them into his dressing room and signed a contract. Then he had them meet him in Chicago, and for the first few recording sessions, they mostly disappeared into a kind of choir of vocalists, musicians in the band who doubled as singers. But then finally, he gave Crosby his first solo on Muddy Water, which is an interesting song in that it was written by an integrated team, a white composer and a black lyricist. And lyrically, it's basically a typical idyl about the South down Dixie way. It's part of the lyric goes. But right away, you can hear Bing's superb time, and the way he articulates, his enunciation was incredible. This is a guy who, you know, he's the only major figure in popular singing who had a full classical education. He won all kinds of elocution and debating awards, and that served him well as a singer. You can also hear he was enormously influenced from his earliest years by Al Jolson. He loved Jolson as well as he loved Armstrong and John McCormick, the Irish tenor, and many other performers. And you can always, in the early records especially, hear those influences kind of vying with each other. And every once in a while in Muddy Water, he will make a certain a word trill a little bit, and you can hear that Jolson impact. But at the same time, you can appreciate that he's opening up a window into the future and something very new is happening here.
Okay, here's Bing Crosby's recording debut with Paul Whiteman.
Muddy water round my feet, muddy water in the street, just God's own shelter down on the delta. Muddy water in my shoes, rocking to those low-down blues. They live in ease and comfort down there, I declare. Been away a year today to wander and roam. I don't care, it's muddy there, but still it's my home. Got my toes turned Dixie way, round that delta let me lay. My heart cries out for muddy water.
That was Bing Crosby's recording debut, made in 1927. We correct ourselves, it wasn't 1926.
Right.
And that was with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. Mm-hmm. Gary, you mentioned his being influenced by Al Jolson. Were Jolson and Crosby rivals?
Oh, no. Jolson was much older than Crosby. He was a huge star. He was a star when Crosby was born. Bing started listening to his records in his early childhood and was just knocked out by them. And then when Bing was about 14, Jolson came to Spokane, and Bing got a job backstage and got to see him and watched his every performance and just, as he said, hung on every word and every movement. And so he just adored Jolson as a performer. And I think it was seeing Jolson that sort of made him contemplate becoming an entertainer in the first place. The interesting thing about his relationship with Jolson is that by the 1940s, when Crosby was, you know, beyond superstardom, he was the most popular, beloved performer in the world, Jolson had some very bad years, and he made his comeback on Crosby's radio show. And there was a complete reversal, because now Crosby was the one who had influenced Jolson. He had showed him how to kind of lower his wattage when he was in a recording studio so that he could sing ballads and not, you know, tear the microphones apart. And most people today remember as Jolson's greatest period as a singer his period from the late 1940s. The earlier records, the ones that made him famous in the teens and 1920s, are fairly difficult to listen to now because they're so theatrical and they don't have that sense of dynamics that you need for a recording studio.
My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. We're talking about his biography of Bing Crosby. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. We're talking about his biography of Bing Crosby. One of the things you find so interesting about Bing Crosby is the way he manages to bring together different strains of American singing, from jazz to minstrelsy, vaudeville, ethnic singing, Irish singing. His father had one of the early Edison phonographs when Crosby was still in grade school. What kind of music did you find out was in the Crosby family collection when Bing was growing up?
Well, he bought, you have to understand that the phonograph was so new and so novel, and he had one of the first in Spokane, that every record, anything that you could get to play on it, was valued, and every record was a mystery until you played it. So Crosby grew up in a period, as did Armstrong, when there were no prejudices about what was hip and what was not hip, what was Mickey Mouse, what was, you know, cool in and out. All that stuff just didn't exist then. They wanted to hear everything. And so we had all of the Irish tenors. His father loved John McCormick and Dennis Sullivan and a lot of singers like that. They had Caruso. They had the comedy records. Cohn on the Telephone was a million-selling comedy record in the turn of the century. They had, as eventually they replaced the cylinder player with a more sophisticated machine that played lateral discs. And by that time, you started to get the jazz bands as of 1917 when Bing was 14 years old. And he immediately gravitated to those. But he listened to everything and absorbed all those performers. And, of course, there were a lot of Jolson records in the house and a lot of vaudeville performers. After he met Mildred Bailey, he listened a lot to Ethel Waters, Bessie Smith, McKinney's Cotton Pickers, Six Brown Brothers, which was a saxophone group, Ukulele Ike. He had a lot of Ukulele Ike's records.
Bing Crosby went to college, studied law, and it was while he was studying law that he bought a set of drums through a mail order catalog, and that really changed his life. Why did he buy a set of drums, and what connection did it make for him?
He was playing in the school band and with a bunch of high school kids, and he saw he'd been saving up. He worked like a dog. I mean, I go into some detail about all the jobs he had. Just unbelievable. I mean, 6 in the morning, he'd be working in a skid row place cleaning up after alcoholics, and then he'd first go on a newspaper route, and then he'd manage to be at Mass all before his first class. And he saved up his money, and he ordered the set of drums with the palm tree on the bass drum and the gooseneck cymbal attached to it. And there was a guy, a high school kid. Bing was in college at this point, and there was a high school kid named Al Rinker who was at a different neighborhood of Spokane. And he had put together a little group of musicians, and they had just fired their drummer because he couldn't keep time. And somebody said, "There's this guy at Gonzaga who just bought his own set." So Rinker called him up, introduced himself, said that he had a band. Would he like to come over to the house with his drums and for rehearsal? So Bing said, sure. He carried the drums over. And now Bing at this point is like 21 years old, and these are a bunch of 17-year-olds, and it didn't bother him in the least. And they had this first rehearsal, and he loved it. They all were very excited about the sound. They liked the way Bing kept the beat. And after the first number, Bing was so delighted with it, he said, I can also sing. And he reached into his drum case and pulled out a tiny little megaphone as if to prove the point. And when they heard him sing, they thought, wow, this is incredible. They've got a drummer and a singer now. And the band was called the Musicalators. And they worked for about a year in Spokane.
Then Al Rinker and Bing Crosby ended up joining the Paul Whiteman Band, and then with the addition of the songwriter and singer Harry Barris, they became known as the Rhythm Boys.
Right.
What kind of act did they work up together?
Well, the first piece that they did was Mississippi Mud, and that was hugely successful. And it's funny, when you talk to people today who were alive then, and I interviewed quite a few, everybody remembers Mississippi Mud. Basically, it was a comedy musical act. They all loved comedy. Crosby, of course, that was one of the things he admired about Jolson. And then, of course, when he saw Armstrong in Chicago, that was the other thing. I mean, here was this genius musician who would stop the show and do comedy routines. Armstrong would reach in the back and pull out a deacon's coat and put it on and a pair of glasses on his nose and introduce himself as the Reverend Satchel Mouth and do, you know, parodies. And the idea that you could mix comedy and music was very appealing to Crosby. They would do dance steps. They would do imitations, all kinds of things. But basically, they worked up on records anyway a very basic approach to harmonizing, with Bing singing the solos. Harry Barris would kind of vocalize a cymbal-like sound, a pa, to kind of keep the rhythm going and sort of exclamatory points in the performances. I think the greatest record of the Rhythm Boys, at least my favorite, was a thing called The Bluebirds and the Blackbirds Got Together, which is basically a song about integration and very much ahead of its time. And it's a good example of how well they meshed, not only singing together, but just improvising one-liners and talking to each other and just throwing in little verbal fillips throughout the performance.
Well, why don't we hear it?
Look at my doorstep, look at my doorstep, look at the bluebirds, look at the blackbirds, look at the good luck, look at the bad luck, look at the good luck and the bad luck there. Never saw bluebirds mingle with blackbirds, never saw bluebirds deal with these blackbirds, and never knew good luck ever could perch with care. Now I overheard those birdies talking today, and I know just why they're acting this way. Now first the bluebird said, we've got to have sunny weather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. Then the blackbird said, we're birds of a different feather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. And when they talked it over, they let the blackbirds bring rain. And then the bluebirds all agreed to bring that sunshine again. For we can't have rain or sunshine that lasts forever. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together.
Ba 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 ba.
We'll talk more about Bing Crosby with his biographer Gary Giddens in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with jazz critic Gary Giddens. He's the author of the first volume of a biography of Bing Crosby, which covers his early years from 1903 to 1940. This month marked the centennial of Crosby's birth. Three double-feature DVDs have been released, covering Crosby's screen career from 1936 to 49. Giddens describes Crosby as the most influential and successful popular performer in the first half of the 20th century. Here's another one of Crosby's early recordings from 1927. This is Mary, featuring Paul Whiteman and his orchestra with Bix Beiderbecke on cornet.
What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for, Mary? What are you thinking about? Who are you thinking about, Mary? The bees are buzzing. They're buzzing right in my ear. And they keep on asking, hey, what's the big idea? Think of the moon above. Doesn't it speak of love, Mary? Why do you lead me on? Why do you be so contrary? You wouldn't let my castles come tumbling down. Think of the things in store. What are you waiting for, Mary?
What do you think playing with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra exposed Crosby to in terms of musical venues and musical styles?
The whole experience with Whiteman was an education. And for the first of all, it took him around the country. Until he was, 22, he had never been outside of the state of Washington, hardly been outside Spokane. And then he toured vaudeville, but that was all in California, from San Diego up to San Francisco. Whiteman took him from throughout the Midwest into New York. When he got to New York, he was exposed to Duke Ellington, Ethel Waters, all these incredible bands, uptown, midtown, and he drank it all in. He spent all of his nights in Harlem going from one club to another, hanging out at jam sessions. He roomed for a while with Bix Beiderbecke, who became a very close friend, and they spent a lot of time together at speakeasies, and they also were at jam sessions in New York and Chicago. Whenever they hit Chicago, and later on in New York as well, he would look up Louis Armstrong. And he began to just take to the whole fast life of that period. I mean, he was a poster boy for Prohibition, and that Prohibition was the unenforceable law that everybody felt an obligation to flaunt. And so he became quite a heavy drinker, and he really took in the exciting nightlife of that period. He went to all the shows he could. He met all kinds of famous personalities like Maurice Chevalier and Ravel. and heard every kind of music that was available, and there wasn't much that wasn't available in New York in those days.
Sounds like he became a marijuana user, too.
He smoked some pot, I think probably began with Armstrong, and although I don't think he smoked it in later years, he did advocate its legalization right up to the end.
Now,
of course, it was legal when he was, you know, until the 1930s. So in that period, you know, it wasn't that big a deal.
Well, let's hear another track that I think helps illustrate how music was changing and how Crosby was helping to change it. And this is another Rhythm Boys track.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another track with Paul Whiteman. It's from Monday On. And it's Crosby and Al Rinker with another singer named Skin Young.
Right.
And it starts with a real barbershop quartet kind of sound, the old sound, and then kind of segues into this kind of new, fun, scat singing kind of sound.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit more about this track?
It's not even barbershop. It's just so typical of that gender-bending tenor quality. The first voice, as I recall, is a kind of falsetto, every day is what? And it just, you know, it's so dated, and you think, oh, my God, what are we listening to here? And then right away, the Rhythm Boys come in and double the tempo. The idea of the arrangement was to use all the singers in Whiteman's band, which was to use the tenor trio, which consisted of musicians doubling as this very poor singers for the most part, and then the Rhythm Boys, and play one against the other. And then Crosby comes in for the solo, and here's a good example where you can just see it's night and day between Bing and all the other voices on the track.
Okay, this is Bing Crosby.
Also, I should just mention that it has a wonderful trumpet solo by the great Big Spiderbeck.
Okay, let's hear it.
Every day was blue. Because I'll be happy from Monday on.
That's from Monday On, recorded in 1928 with Bing Crosby as one of the Rhythm Boys with Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. How did Crosby end up becoming a solo singer?
The guys in Whiteman's band, Whiteman's band consisted of several cliques. The older clique wanted to continue playing the music that Whiteman had become famous for, which was dance band music. The younger guys in the band, the jazz fans, they wanted the band to go more in the direction of the genuine jazz players that he began to hire in 1927, 1928. The jazz guys loved Crosby. They were constantly lobbying Whiteman to give Crosby more solos. The jazz arrangers, Bill Challis preeminent among them, wanted to write all of his pieces for Crosby and for Beiderbecke. He didn't like the older players, and this caused tremendous dissension in the band, and actually it caused two of Whiteman's biggest stars and oldest friends to leave the band because basically they were jealous. Crosby eventually had all kinds of arguments with the band. He was late. Whiteman penalized him for over a drinking incident and some other things, and they were just at loggerheads. And at some point, they just decided to have a break, and the contract was basically torn up. And they began to work as a group, the Rhythm Boys, and weren't having much luck. And then they went back to Hollywood, and after a while got this incredible engagement at the Coconut Grove, which didn't pay them very much, but it made them hugely popular with the movie colony. And instantly, Bing Crosby was accepted into that world.
Into the movie world.
Yeah.
So he starts making movies and starts being a name unto himself and a soloist as a singer.
Well, one of the people who came to hear him at the Grove was Mack Sennett. Mack Sennett was at this point considered something of a has-been. He had been known as the king of comedy, produced the most successful series of comedy films during the silent era. And now he was looking for a voice. He wanted to make some sound films, and he was amazed at how funny Crosby was and also at how much the audiences just seemed to love him and would come back night after night. So he signed Crosby to a series of six two-reel films, and those were Crosby's first important appearances on film. And then as those became more successful and Bing went back to New York and had a huge success in late 1931 on the radio, he started getting offers from the film studios to be in feature films, and he went with Paramount to make The Big Broadcast. And The Big Broadcast was just a blockbuster. It basically brought back musicals to the cinema. And after that, he was signed instantly to a three-film deal and ended up being at Paramount for the next 20 years.
What was his image in his early films?
Very different from what most people remember. When you watch a picture like the Big Broadcast, it's quite startling. He plays an alcoholic. He plays a character very much like himself. And in fact, the name of the character in the film is Bing Crosby. He's mobbed by women on the street, and his clothes are torn off, and he's constantly getting drunk and missing gigs. And at one point, he decides when his girl leaves him to commit suicide with a friend. And there's this scene where they think they've turned on the gas and expecting to die and have all these hallucinations. And they're saved by the good girl who loves Bing. And you expect, because of Hollywood conventions that we've all grown up with, that he will end up with a good girl. But he ends up with the tramp who betrayed him in the first reel. So it's very different from what you expect. And he continued to play that kind of character for a while in Going Hollywood. The most famous scene in the film is his big drunk scene in a Mexican bordello.
My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He's the author of a biography of Bing Crosby. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. We're talking about his biography of Bing Crosby. How does Crosby's singing change once he goes out on his own?
A number of things happened. In the late 20s, early 30s, he had a very appealing, slight gravel to his voice. It was caused by nodes on his vocal cords. And in fact, when he was insured by Paramount with Lloyd's of London, a proviso in the contract was that he could never have surgery to remove the nodes because they thought he would lose the vocal quality that made him so famous and popular on the radio. But by taking care of himself and keeping quiet for a short while, the nodes began to recede. So his voice changed, and in place of that hoarseness, there was a brand new clarity and brilliance that really comes into a peak in the mid and late 1930s, which I think in some ways is his greatest period as a singer. And at the same time, thanks in part to his producer, Jack Capp, who created Decca Records, he was being encouraged to lose the mannerisms. Now, one of the things Crosby brought to pop singing that was so important was that he got rid of almost immediately of all the Rococo mannerisms that characterized singers when he was coming up. He really focused on the lyric, what the lyric meant. He focused on the clean melodic line, which is why he was so appealing to songwriters who loved writing songs for him. But as he matured in the 30s, he got even more spare in his style and was just very, very clear in hitting every note. Pitch was always right. His improvisations were still often ingenious, but they were subtler. And as he got older, he became more and more laid back in his style, more cool. Sometimes he sounded as though he were phoning in performances, and very often, especially in the 40s when he was recording almost, you know, daily, he was phoning them in. But by that time, he was so much the professional that you couldn't always tell, because he learned those songs. He had an audiographic memory. He heard it once, he knew the song, and rarely made mistakes. When he makes mistakes, audiences loved when he made mistakes, especially on the radio, because it was so unusual to hear that from him.
Let's hear a recording that was a turning point in Crosby's career, and this is Just One More Chance. What does this signify in his career?
This was a song that was written expressly for him by Sam Coslow and his partner, and it was a huge hit. It wasn't, as I say in the book, it wasn't quite Heartbreak Hotel, but it was a turning point because it brought Crosby out of the jazz milieu, out of the jazz cult, and into the mainstream. And tens of thousands of people who didn't know Crosby before got to know him because of this record, which he incidentally used on his very first radio broadcast.
And where is he in terms of the development of his singing style on this recording?
This is very early. He's only been a soloist on his own now for about a year, and or I don't know, maybe a couple of years, and he's still trying to figure out what his style is. This is a period when his recordings fluctuate tremendously. Sometimes he's rather mannered. Sometimes he'll try some kind of a melismatic gimmick. Other times he's swinging away at jazz. Other times he's doing fairly lachrymose ballad. He's really trying to figure out who he is and codify what his style is going to be. And this is one of those breakthrough records where you can hear the Crosby cry, the sob, the intimate approach to lyrics that was just so... It just knocked the audiences out.
So this is Bing Crosby recorded in 1931.
Just one more chance to prove it's you alone I care for. Each night I say a little prayer for. Just one more chance. Just one more night. Taste the kisses that enchant me. I'd want no others if you'd grant me just one more chance. I've learned the meaning of repentance. Now you're the jury at my trial. I know that I should serve my sentence. Still I'm hoping all the while you'll give me just one more word. I said that I was glad to start out.
That's Bing Crosby, recorded in 1931. My guest Gary Giddens has written a new biography of Crosby called Pocketful of Dreams, and it covers his early years through 1940. Volume 2 of this biography is in the works. This recording is one of the recordings that helped make Crosby a star. How did fame affect him?
One of the reasons that audiences so loved Crosby is because fame didn't seem to affect him very much at all. He so obviously loved his good fortune. He loved the money. He loved the sporting life that he was leading, that audiences could enjoy it vicariously with him throughout the Depression. Nobody was envious of Crosby. No matter how much wealth he accrued, he seemed to be the same basic guy. And in most respects, he was. I mean, for example, he never missed Mass. One thing that did change is he stopped drinking. With the beginning of his film career, he just turned around completely. But even when he was a drunk, he always went to Mass, and that never stopped. In his later years, his butler described him to me as being on his knees every night in front of the bed before he went to sleep. He always kept basically the same hours. Except for those roustabout years, he basically went to sleep early and got up at the crack of dawn as he had as a kid. Bob Hope talks about getting to the studio at, 7:38 in the morning, and Bing's shoes are untied. And he said, "Didn't you have time to tie your shoes?" And Crosby said, "Oh, I just, shot a bucket of balls." And Hope would say, incredulously, he said, "That was before we went to work in the morning." So he was a hardworking guy. When he finished the day shooting, he would then go to play golf. And he was always doing something. He was constantly occupied. So the older Crosby, the rich Crosby, the famous Crosby, is not that unlike the young Crosby that the Jesuits had by the small hairs in Spokane.
My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He's the author of a biography of Bing Crosby, covering the first part of Bing Crosby's career. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He's also the author of a biography of Bing Crosby. In the 1920s, Crosby might have signified what was new in music and this excitement about jazz. But by the 1950s and 60s, when rock and roll was taking over the pop music charts, Crosby signified everything that was old and out of date and middle
That's
of the
right.
road. What did you first start hearing? Did Crosby used to represent to you what you didn't like about music? Was there a turning point in your mind where you started to get interested in him?
I never paid much attention to Crosby except for the records he made with Beiderbecke and Whiteman. I mean, I only bought the Whiteman records because I wanted to hear Beiderbecke, and Crosby came in kind of as a, you know, a bonus. And I always liked the way he sang on those things. I liked his time, his phrasing, and, of course, the sound of his voice, which is like nothing else in that era. I pretty much dismissed everything afterwards. In 1976, I guess it was, he came to New York for his first live performance in a concert hall before paying audiences in more than 40 years and played at the Eurus Theater, and I covered it for the Village Voice and was allowed to attend a rehearsal and briefly spoke with him. And I was fascinated by him. I thought a lot of the later stuff was, as you say, middle of the road, white bread, uninteresting. But there was something about him that was absolutely compelling. And at the end of the performance, he sang this now legendary medley. It's the longest medley, I think, of all time, of something like 45 of his hits. And it was an astounding virtuoso performance. One, you know, 16-bar excerpt after another. And with each one, the audience just went crazy, all the people who remembered those songs. So I wrote a piece about it. It's a chapter in my very first book from 1981 called Riding on a Blue Note. And somebody who read it in the book said to me, you know, very interesting what you say about Crosby, but you dismissed his whole second half of his career. And I said, really? Why shouldn't I? And at that point, he really got me starting to listen to some of the later stuff. And it opened my eyes. I realized that I was so jazz-centric that I simply wasn't allowing myself to listen to Crosby and a lot of other performers like Tony Bennett and Sinatra and more pop-oriented performers who were working with a somewhat different aesthetic. And the more I listened to Crosby, the more I realized that even the most pop-oriented, novelty-type pieces that he did always have that incredible time. You know, Jake Hanna said to me he never played with anybody who had... He said the two musicians he worked with who had the best time were Count Basie and Bing Crosby, which is a hell of a statement. And you always hear that. He's always got that focus on the one, so that even when he seems to be phoning it in, there's a wonderful musicality about what he's doing.
A lot of people who haven't even paid any attention to Crosby singing know one thing about him, which is that his son Gary wrote a book that accused Bing of abusing him. I know this comes in your second volume, which mm-hmm. is in the works, but just as a preview of that, how much of that do you think was true?
Some of it was true, some of it was not. Gary himself conceded that there were a lot of exaggerations and overstatements in the book. I spent many, many hours with Gary. His brothers deny it absolutely, but I think they were a little bit in denial. There's no question that Bing was very strict and that he used the same corporal punishment that he was brought up with, and he boasts of it in his own memoir, Call Me Lucky. But throughout interviews in the late 1950s, Bing says he greatly regretted using corporal punishment and would not do so with his second family and didn't.
Are you looking forward to writing volume two of this, or were you so much more interested in the early stuff that volume two is going to be comparatively difficult to get through?
No, on the contrary, I thought that Road to Singapore was a true ending for the first volume. It just seemed to me to end that story. But to me, the greatest story of all about Crosby is 1946. That's the peak year of his career. It's the year when he single-handedly turned radio from a live medium into a canned medium, financed the invention and production of tape and tape recorders, and just turned the industry around. That's a story I've always wanted to tell, and it will be central to the second volume.
Well, I look forward to you telling it. And thank you so much for talking with us about Bing
Crosby.
Thank
you, Terry.
Gary Giddens recorded in 1999 after the publication of his book, Bing Crosby, A Pocketful of Dreams, The Early Years. Volume 2 is in the works. Volume 1 ends in 1940, the year of Bing Crosby's first road movie with Bob Hope. Hope celebrates his 100th birthday on Thursday. May 3rd marked the centennial of Crosby's birth. Here's Crosby and Hope in their 1942 film, Road to Morocco.
We're off on the road to Morocco. This taxi is tough on the spine.
Beats the bus, huh, Junior?
Beats me.
Where we're going,
why we're going, how can we be sure?
I'll lay you 8 to 5 that we meet Dorothy L'Amour.
Off on the road to Morocco. Hang on till the end of the line.
I hear this country's where they do the dance of the seven veils.
We tell you more, but we would have the censor on our tails.
We certainly do get around. Like Webster's Dictionary, we're Morocco bound. We're off.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Chirac. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close by wishing a happy 100th birthday to Bob Hope.